League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique Studio Plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your Studio Plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Hello and welcome to The Sci Guys, the show where we talk about the crazy, weird and wonderful stories from the science world. I'm Corey and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, the linguistic Luke Cutfer.
Ahoy there!
Diese Woche reden wir about language learners and Sprache Studenten.
Me gusta mucho comer.
But first... we have OE Spotify update. Now, look, we have 47,000 followers on Spotify. A few more than that, 47,851. Everyone tells a friend, they tell a friend, we get more followers. Really cool, really great, awesome, nice, right? But what I find more interesting is that we now have Q&As on Spotify. We ask a Q and they A our Q. And so I have an A to one of our Qs. It says... I want to go to space like a little kid wants to go to space. I want to see stars and galaxies and fly around just because. On the other hand, I am terrified of the thought of actually going to space. There you go. So if you answer one of our Q&As on Spotify, you might have the chance for that A to be read out on the podcast. The A to the Q. Shall we get to the Q that I'm going to A you for you to A?
A me right now. Q master.
How many and which languages do you speak?
Yo hablo un poco de español, and I speak some English. And
some.
Sorry, yes.
Now, if you would like to answer this question, go ahead and do it over on Spotify, or you could head to the YouTube comments and do that there too. Or hey, why don't you find a little ant and have it write it out in the sand? Take a picture and throw that picture into the ocean, and it might make its way to us. So let's get into the episode, Luke. Around the world, an estimated 60 to 70% of people speak more than one language. But the real question is, how does this affect the brain? Now, I know I did a Spotify update. I want to do a Spotify update, but this was a Patreon vote episode. So if you want to vote on episode topics, go ahead and join our Patreon. You can submit topics. You can vote on topics. You get bonus episodes, an entirely separate show called After Dark. It's all very good. It's available on Spotify now for people who are on our Patreon. Anyway, they've asked us to do an episode on bilinguals. So my question to you is, you know, so many people speak more than one language, but how does that affect the brain?
Okay, so I have read vaguely a little bit about this.
Oh God, well, don't say too much.
Oh, well, I'll just say that it affects it positively. There you go, top line. Es bueno.
That's good. I messaged two friends of the pod who, you know, are bilingual or multilingual, and both of them couldn't make it today.
I could have brought my wife.
She seems like she'll be busy.
She is. Yeah, she is busy.
Yeah, okay. Right. Exactly. I thought so. But yeah, no. So, you know, we're going to muddle through this as two people who collectively can maybe speak about one and a bit languages.
Yeah.
That's adding them together, by the way. Not like,
You speak a bit of German. I speak a bit of Spanish.
We barely have any English.
0.2 of a language between us. And then we can speak sort of 90% English.
Combined between us. That's like 45 each. Well, actually, realistically, I'm like 80 and you're hovering around 10. All of the words Luke has ever said on this podcast are the only words he knows. And to be honest, he forgets a lot of them afterwards. He never uses the same word twice. So before we talk about the effect of knowing multiple languages on the brain, we should probably figure out what a language is, right?
Yeah, so a language will be one of those things that is annoyingly hard to define. like a chair.
A language is like a chair.
A language is like
a chair. So you're sitting in a language right now.
I'm sitting in a great big blue language. Recording a podcast using chairs.
So continue.
Yeah, so it'll have sort of fuzzy edges, I'm guessing, because you've got sort of dialects are in there, and that's sort of like sub languages sort of, and then you have some languages that cross over from each other and languages evolve from other languages. So I'm guessing it's going to be an annoying thing to define.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. I mean, if I were to sit here and try and define language, every single linguist that was watching this would probably collectively like curl up into a tiny ball and then explode in that's what linguists do,
yeah,
right?
Tom Scott's going to turn into a hedgehog.
Don't call Tom Scott a linguist.
I know, because it annoys him.
Don't do that. Tom Scott studied linguistics and came and did our episode on linguistics. But is Tom Scott a linguist? You can find out by watching our episode on linguistics. Go ahead and do that. But yeah, no. If I was to sit here and give you an absolute definition of a language that I said was objective, yes, linguists would not be happy, because you're right. It's another one of those things that we can't define, because it's very made up. It's like very, very made up. You know, the concept of saying this is a language and there are hard boundaries between, there are languages that are, well, there are some sign languages that are kind of mutually intelligible. So that's one thing that, you know, we would sort of mention when talks about sort of differentiating languages, whether someone speaking one language to another person who doesn't speak that language but speaks a similar language, whether they would be able to understand each other both speaking their own languages. Like that time when I was in university and I used the little German I had to speak to my friend.
How did you get him?
Very good. Don't ask questions you don't want to hear the answer to. So anyway, I was speaking to my friend who is Dutch, and his first language I think is English, but never mind that. He speaks fluent Dutch. That's the language. He speaks fluent Dutch, and I was speaking German to him with the little German I knew at the time, probably better than I know now, to be honest with you. But and he was speaking to me in Dutch, and we were actually able to kind of have a conversation because they're not the same language by any means, but there were enough similarities that we could kind of figure out what each other meant in a similar way, I suppose, to like if an English person hears Scots, there's enough sort of overlap between Scots and English to kind of pick up roughly what someone's saying.
Yeah, my wife, who I mentioned, who's bilingual sort of, is Norwegian, and she can understand some of the other Scandinavian languages sort of more or less. And also, interestingly, I think I might have told this sort of anecdote before, but I went to Norway with her, and Norwegian for
Norway.
Out. Anyway, Norwegian for out is ut, U-T.
Oh, yeah.
And that's also how you'd say out in a Scottish accent.
Oh, yeah, get it.
Yeah, and so I found that really fascinating. Was it like, because obviously writing comes after language, right? So writing something down...
The written word comes after the spoken word. Yeah,
and so in that sense, the way of saying out if you're Scottish is the same as the way of saying out if you're Norwegian. You just write it down differently.
Yeah, which makes sense, right? Like, I mean, when you think about... We can't let this turn into an episode about how interesting languages are. Like, but I'll say this, and then we can kind of move on to the next part. What I find really interesting is how languages evolve, because obviously things just sound like things, and because people aren't necessarily, you know, for most of human history, you know, people weren't reading constantly. That wasn't like, you know, reading is kind of our main way of communicating nowadays, but like literacy rates were not that high, you know, even not that long ago, right? You know, like people weren't communicating through text. They were communicating through speech most often. I mean, we probably communicate through speech, you know, primarily, I guess, but we use a lot of text as well. Anyway, the point is that the way words would evolve and different things would change is just people saying things differently or sometimes mishearing things. There are so many things that have come from people mishearing. So for example, an orange. Have you ever noticed that oranges are different in different languages? Like, as in English, we're pretty much the only ones that call an orange. Everything, like a bunch of other languages that are kind of nearby, say naranja.
Well, or France says orange, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, naranja in Spanish.
Yeah, exactly, right? Like that word, an orange. Happens to a lot of words. So nickname, it used to be, I think, like eek name, like an eek name.
Wow.
I think maybe eek meant something like short or whatever, right? And that was like an eek name, which changed to a nickname. Wow. Right. And that happened. That's just one way that can happen. But there's so many other things wherein, like, you know, gosh, buccaneer, the word buccaneer, that came from, I think, the kind of pot that a pot that was used to cook in, or it's a style of sort of cooking something that obviously if you were a buccaneer, you would most often sort of do. So they kind of became to known by this kind of cooking vessel or style of cooking, but then it was kind of degraded as different languages got hold of it and just said it kind of differently, you know? And so it went from like whatever the original word was, which is probably something like Buchanan or something like that, right? To buccaneer. It's so interesting.
So weird.
Yeah, right? It's so cool. Like how like you take a word that is not familiar in your language and just say, for anime, right? Anime, very Japanese word. Do you know where they got the word from?
Animation?
Yes, in English.
What?
Anime is the word. Is anime.
Silly.
Anime is what we call Japanese animated. Like animation, right? But they got the word anime, which sounds to me, to my very, you know, anglicized ears. I say anglicized as though it happened to me. My English speaking ears, they don't speak English. Anyway, it sounds to my ears like a very kind of, it sounds quite Japanese, but no, it is just animation. And obviously it comes from animation, but like it's, languages are weird and funny and odd like that. The point is, also, sorry, last one, disco.
Yeah.
Where does that come from?
Discotheque.
So disco and disc have the same root, obviously. Like as in a disc that we use to listen to...
To music.
To music is the same root as the word disco because they all come from the same...
But it'll be the disc as in the record as opposed to like a compact disc that we had as children, like a CD. Yeah. A disc as in like a sphere, like a circle.
It's mad.
Oh, so it's like disc, but it's also technic. It's like, it's kind of like there's lights and it's kind of like technicolor technical.
No. So this is way cooler. It's discotheque and bibliotheque. So bibliotheque is library. Discotheque is kind of like a record collection, a collection of records, which then became to be known like, you know, as the kind of
music,
if you
library.
Had a collection of records, like a music library, but then if you go to a discotheque, you go to a place that's playing that sort of playing music, and then that's disco, and then disco is like a style of music that's played at disco. It's
wow.
I love it's so cool, right? Or last one, helicopter. You think if you, it's Greek, so it's helico, heli and copter would be the two roots you think. No, it's helico and pater. Pater meaning wing, you know that from pterodactyl.
Wow.
And helico meaning spiral wing. And if you try and break it down, you probably think heli, like we call it a helipad, but it's really a helicopad. Do you know what I mean? It's
yeah.
Like, anyway, language, what is a language? We're not really sure how to define it. Properly, I've got a quote here from Britannica. Language, a system of conventional spoken or manual, sort of signed or written symbols by means of which human beings, as members of a social group and participants in its culture, express themselves. The functions of a language include communication, the expression of identity, play, imaginative expression, and emotional release. But the article goes on to say that any succinct definition of language makes a number of presuppositions and then begs a number of questions. So, you know, like any definition you give of language, you have assumptions that you're bringing into it, mm-hmm. and it's going to be inherently kind of like cyclical. It's the same way as trying to define like what a gender is. Yeah, people say woman is adult human female. Sure, not like it's not really you don't use woman to mean adult human female all the time, right? Because cartoon characters and non-human like fictional thing, you use gender terms for non-human things,
it's
right?
So like there a must character.
Yeah,
it's like
exactly.
You're referencing an archetypal character, I suppose, aren't you?
Yeah. So the point being that gender would then have to be something that isn't exclusively related to sex. If you're using gendered like gendered terms for things that don't have a sex, you know what I mean? Like a boat, right? Like you like the boat. What? So is a boat an adult human female because we call it she/her or pronouns biological?
Show me those
Ben
boats titties. That's the side guys out of context right there.
Oh, absolutely.
Show me that boat's titty.
But the point being that, like, you know, if you want to try and define a gender, like what is a woman? Well, a woman is like a person that identifies with the gender category of woman. Like, do you know what I mean? And what is woman? Well, it's difficult to define it because, like, you could say adult human female. You would be not super correct. You'd be correct in most instances, but you'd have a lot of the fuzzy edges that you just shaved off. You're just kind of ignoring them. And the same, you know, if any definition you give for language is necessarily going to be limited or in some instances incorrect, because when you dig down into it, right, okay, well, what separates this language from another language? What makes this a dialect and not a language? And I think what was mentioned by Tom in our linguistics episode is a language is a dialect with an army. You know, like as a
sure,
right.
Well, I think what's important to mention there as well is that when you're talking about like gender and stuff like that, is that these things do change over time. And yeah. So even if at some point in time we meant sort of adult human female when we sure. talked about a woman, if it becomes clear that there are people who, for in a social context, do not want to be referred in a certain way, it's okay for the reason to just be because we respect them and want to include them in society.
Yes, you are so right. But we should probably get back to the episode topic. We've veered off so far already. I don't want to just talk about languages. We know what a language is from what we've just discussed. It is something that we cannot define properly. But we all kind of, we vibe, we know what a language is generally, right? And to be honest, knowing the specific definition of a language isn't super important for this episode anyway, so let's just move on. I want to talk about bilinguals, because that's the topic for this episode. First off, let's talk about sort of language acquisition in bilinguals. I don't want to spend too much time on this, because we could do an entire episode on language acquisition, could do an entire episode on bilingual language acquisition. I just want to briefly touch on this, because it's a question that comes up a lot, is that if you raise a kid bilingual, as in learning two languages at once, you're not going to confuse them? And what do you think the answer is, Luke?
No.
Very confident.
It's amazingly no, yeah. but no.
Yeah, you'd think that you're speaking two completely different languages to a child, and we think children are dumb. But children are less dumb than you think. They just cannot communicate or regulate themselves emotionally. And yeah, they're not like necessarily as, I guess, they don't have the intellectual capabilities that an adult has because they're much younger and they've not developed yet. But the point being that, raising a kid bilingual doesn't result in them being confused. And, you know, something we were mentioning sort of last week was common sense and whatnot, right? About how common sense can be deceptive, shall we say, in terms of common sense would tell you that a child sort of mixing up words from different languages would mean that the child is confused about which language is which and they don't understand, and that's actually really bad for them. But actually, it's kids mixing up words from different languages when they're being raised bilingual is just a normal part of bilingual sort of like language acquisition. Like, you know what I mean? It doesn't mean that the child is, obviously there's differences for different abilities, different sort of neurocognitive conditions and whatnot. But generally, a kid mixing up different words or using words from different languages when they're bilingual, when they're growing up, it's normal. It's fine.
They do that anyway.
Yeah.
With one language. They mix words up all the time.
Oh my God, yeah. I want to do an episode on, have you heard of WUGS?
WUGS.
You've not? Okay, fantastic. I want to do an episode on that, which is kind of about how children understand language, whether they just sort of like it just gets programmed into them by remembering a lot of stuff, or whether they have like a sort of I guess almost an inventive step. Basically, to really paraphrase, you show a kid a drawing of this thing, it's called a WUG, right? You're like, this is one WUG, here are two, there are two, and then the child WUGS. Says what? Yeah. And you just basically, the thing is, you introduce a kid to something they've never been introduced to before, because it's entirely made up, and you try and get them to sort of use the plural of that word.
You know, like, I did that with the, when thinking about,
yeah, no,
it,
exactly.
I put an S at the end.
Yeah.
Wow.
Or like, you know, Jimmy is splanking. Yesterday he did the same thing. Yesterday, Jimmy
splunked.
Yeah, no, or splunk. You know, like, it's. We'll do an episode on it, but it's basically how you form that sort of stuff, yeah, in your brain. It's really interesting.
I wonder if they do those sorts of tests on ChatGPT as well.
Oh,
because there's a great test you do with ChatGPT. Like, it now, I think it now knows the answer, but it used to say, like, there are three towels drying on the line. It will take them 3 hours to dry. How many hours will it take for 9 towels to dry? And it'd be like, it will take 9 hours. Or the best one, if it takes one woman 9 months to make a baby, how long will it take 9 women to make a baby? And it's like, 1 month. Like, Luke, really confidently.
You say that, I promise you there are people that would answer those same things.
No, I know.
Like,
I know,
a lot of people.
Yeah,
do you know what I mean? Like, I think a lot of people, if you were to ask them the towels drying on a line question, would absolutely give that same answer.
Now, obviously, it depends how big your line is.
Yeah.
But it doesn't qualify that. And so that's a fun sort of intelligence and language test, which I suppose that you could do similar sorts of tests on an AI as you do on a child as it develops.
I guess the difference between an AI language sort of model there and, a child is that it doesn't really need to understand the context or anything like that. The parameters that you've given it, it just gives you the most sort of likely, shall we say. It builds the response that is most likely based on its training, if that makes sense, right?
That's correct, yes.
Yeah. So what I mean is that if you give a situation where it's like, if it takes X, Y time to do something, if you increase X, what happens to Y? Generally, the answer to those questions is going to be what it gives, right? And you're like, what the issue is, that it's just not understanding that there's context that isn't said, which is the limitation of AI compared to...
Well, yes, but not to get on too large a tangent, but we have no way of knowing... When you say, it's just giving the most likely answer, mm-hmm. we have no way of knowing that the way that it comes to that answer is not to sort of build a general understanding of the world that we just don't have access to. It could be forming a basic understanding of the world relative to its language that allows it to be more accurate, mm-hmm. even though we haven't asked it to do that.
No, but I get that. My point, I think, is independent of that. It's more about the fact that the problem there, I think, is more that there is just context that has not been provided, and it has, in its training, it has not been given that context. Likely in the same way that people who answer that question would answer that question. People mm-hmm. who answer that question correctly would answer that question, where there's context that they're just not considering. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah. The ding-a-ling-ling, is that the ad bell?
Oh, God, again? For God's sake, get this guy out of here.
Well, look, I'll tell you how to get the ad bell out of here, because here's what's been happening. Look, over the past few weeks, we've been doing some ads for some stuff, and people have been saying, these are crazy! You're going off the rails! You're interrupting my Sci Guys to make silly jokes about fascist bells and whatnot! I won't stand for it! Well, if you won't stand for it, here's what to do. Here's how to stop us in our tracks, stop us from making these ads, is to go to
sciguys.co.uk/merch
and pick up all of the merch. If we've got no merch to sell, then we've got no merch to promote, and we won't make any more of these silly ads. So if you don't want to see them again, go ahead, sciguys.co.uk/merch, and get yourself some merch. What merch can they get, Luke?
A t-shirt promoting global warming and the effect...
Not promoting global warming, Luke.
I just don't think it's got good enough press.
So it says, thanks, capitalism, with a burning planet Earth on it, because we don't like either of those things. What else can they get, Luke?
I was saying thanks, I thought it was saying thanks, genuinely. Thanks.
What else can they get, Luke?
They can also get a pin badge saying, I am the fourth Sci Guy, to let everybody know that you are, in fact, the fourth Sci Guy, which you only are if you own the badge. And finally, they can get, I think, probably the best thing we've ever made, a sexy scientist calendar, where we hired two of our sexy friends to pose for us, and then I spent an ungodly amount of time photoshopping scientists' faces onto their faces. So you can pick up all of those at sciguys.co.uk/merch and stop us doing these godforsaken ads.
And you better do it quick as well, because the pre-order is ending oh so soon. If you're listening to this as it comes out, you've only got about one or two or maybe even 3 days before you can't get it for the pre-order discount anymore. You can still get it, but thanks to capitalism, you have to pay the full price.
I hate that. So I'm going to go to sciguys.co.uk/merch immediately and buy it all so I can end capitalism somehow and also end these bloody adverts.
That's true. If you buy everything, we'll end capitalism. Let's get back to the show.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
But back to bilingual children and whether or not they're confused. It seems that they're not really confused. Kids and infants, like infants, I think, are actually able to differentiate between different languages, when they're quite young. Obviously, they can't speak the language, but they can.
Can I just ask a quick question on this? How are you? Because I think people will be asking this in their own heads as well. Mm-hmm. When you're saying, is the kid confused? No, the kid is not confused, but the kid is mixing up words between languages. What exactly do you mean? What's the line there for whether the kid's confused or not?
When I'm saying the kid is mixing up, it seems the kid is mixing up. What they're doing would be called code mixing, which is kind of like using... almost borrowing a word from another, like from the language to use it. So it's like, you know how kids don't necessarily know words? Mm-hmm. In one instance, it's like, you know the word for this thing in Spanish, but you're like more accustomed to that than you are for the word in English. Mm. And you use this, like adults do a similar thing. Do you know what I mean? Where they'll pull a word from a language, like, you know, a language that they speak while speaking another language, because the language they're speaking currently, they can't find the word or whatnot. Not always just something like that, it's similar to how, you know, if you only speak one language, you might call any animal that's vaguely dog-like a dog. So like if it's on four legs, that must be a dog. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah. So you kind of get, is what you're getting at kind of that the kid understands fairly early on that there are two separate languages rather than it being one gigantic language that they're learning.
Yeah, they're able to differentiate between the different sort of languages, phonemes and stuff. Generally. That's from what I've read, they're able to differentiate. I mean, there's some interesting sort of things when it comes to language discrimination, which is kind of what you're talking about there, which is differentiating between the two different languages. Bilingual infants need to be able to tell the difference between the two languages. Let's say one parent speaking them in one language, another parent one parent speaking in Spanish, the other parent speaking in German. They need to understand, you know, the differences between those two things because they're not the same language, right? But infants from birth are able to sort of differentiate between two languages that are very different. So if you've got, say, the example sitting in front of me is Tagalog and English. Very different sounding languages, or let's say, like, you know, Mandarin and German, quite different sounding languages, right? From birth, apparently infants are able to discern the difference between those. But what's really interesting about sort of bilinguals as opposed to monolinguals is that bilingual babies will sort of turn to face when it comes to sort of two languages that are being spoken at them, right? So you basically get, it's a screen with a picture of a woman on it or a picture of their mother. And then there's a speaker that's playing a language. And you have two of those, right? And both speakers are playing different languages with, you know, the picture of the person in front of them. The baby will turn its head to face, you know, one of the two, obviously. With monolinguals, they will turn to face the familiar language. Bilinguals will turn to face the unfamiliar language. So if you've got, say, one speaker playing English, another speaker playing German, if you've got a bilingual kid that speaks or a bilingual baby that's being taught English and Spanish, they'll turn to face the German one. Whereas a monolingual who speaks only English will turn to face the English one.
Wow. Yeah, it's like it makes you more curious.
I suppose. Like, the way that I was kind of putting it in my head is I'm like, well, this baby is, I guess, used to... things that are unfamiliar, that sound like languages that sound unfamiliar. And so it's trying to understand that, I guess. But yeah, more curious. It's so interesting. I mean, obviously we don't know whether that's the actual case, what the mechanism behind that is, but it is really, it's a really interesting little sort of factoid there that, you know, there are differences that can be seen so early in something that seems so basic. But yeah, that's kind of a really brief overview on language acquisition for bilinguals, right? You know, it does affect the way that language discrimination ends up happening. I mean, it doesn't, I don't think it has any massive effect on language discrimination itself, but it does have an effect on how the sort of process goes along. What I mean is that, you know, I don't know whether by the time they become adults, there's significant differences between bilinguals and monolinguals when it comes to language differentiation or discrimination. But in the process of sort of, you know, being an infant and growing up, we do see differences sort of in how that's a path that sort of follows. But I want to move on to more about how languages change your thinking or your brain, because we've kind of spoken a little bit about how it changes sort of more basic processes from when you're an infant, but I find it really interesting to think about adults. So something you were mentioning not too long ago in another episode was time. Do you remember what you were saying about languages and time?
Okay, so there are languages which consider time to be coming towards them or time to be moving away from them. So when you have a sentence, for example, like, can we bring this meeting forward? Some people will think that means, like, I would think that means, like, make it sooner. And some people would mean, like, can we make that, like, later in the day? And so, yeah, your concepts are rather than just exist, like, affecting how you sort of communicate with people, it also affects other concepts about, like, for example, time or how you interact with other people and all that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. And we got a correction for you.
Ooh.
Yes. So I think you are so right in what you were saying. And what you just said there was correct as well. But I think the issue was that the languages you used as examples.
I guess it's French.
I think you said French. And French people do, you were right, French people do speak about it, sort of time coming towards them or having time, I think. I can't remember the exact comment. But you were generally sort of correct in what you were saying. But that wasn't necessarily an example that sort of matches there. I think the examples that I've got are, let's say, Hebrew, right? In English, what direction does text go?
Left to right.
Exactly. We read text from left to right. And in Hebrew, what direction does text go? What direction do you read?
Oh, God. I think right to left.
Yep. Well done. Yep. Good process of elimination.
It's not up and down. Well, because it could be up and down. Like
Chinese. Or Mandarin, I think. Yeah,
I think hieroglyphics as well, maybe.
Hieroglyphs, really? Are they?
I'm going to get another correction. I'm going to say, I don't know.
I would say that hieroglyphics, I don't think they're a language so much as just a writing system. But yes.
Sure.
Yeah. I'm not saying that for you. We're saying it for the little pedants.
Don't worry, we'll ask Tom Scott.
Stop doing that.
Okay? I'm sorry. Stop doing that. I'll ask my sister. She studied linguistics.
Okay, good. Do you want to go on to lateral again? Tom Scott?
Please have me back, Tom Scott. I'm very sorry, Tom Scott.
Stop winding him up, okay? Because you know that Tom Scott watches all...
I know. And I know that he will actually find it quite distressing. Bless him. Okay, I'm very sorry. Tom Scott is not a linguist. Thank you. Stop saying it.
Yes, thank you, Luke. Anyway, so we're talking about different languages. So Hebrew and English, for example, let's say... Hebrew goes right to left, English left to right when you're reading it. So when we're trying to sort of place stuff spatially, let's say, in English, or for English speakers, if you're saying, okay, place these images in a timeline, they'll place the timeline going from left to right in terms of sort of chronological order. People that speak Hebrew are more likely to do it the other way. You know, it's quite interesting, right? So time goes from left to right for English speakers generally because we read from left to right. That's just a sort of natural thing for us.
Okay, so I've got an example of how you can kind of wrap your head around that, because obviously conceptually you can understand, you can imagine what that might be like, but actually experientially that feels totally bizarre if you're somebody whose language moves from left to right, right?
Yeah.
So imagine if I asked you to sort of order events that happened before and after your birth. Right?
But nothing happened before your birth, Luke.
Now, nothing happened before my birth. So if you were born after me, congratulations, you do exist. And if you were born before me, you were a figment of my imagination for a while. I wonder what that was like for you. So if you imagine things that you have that happened like 10 years before your birth, that would be like on the left-hand side of that center point, the center point being your birth. And something that happened 10 years after your birth would be like on the right-hand side. And that's not exactly things moving left, right to left, but it's things sort of being on the opposite side of a center point, which to me feels kind of weird, right?
If you think about it another way, is when we did number lines in school, or even if you write numbers,
it would be
weird to write the numbers increasing from right to left. So one, and then to the left of the one,
exactly.
Two, three, it would seem odd. It'd be like you're counting down because you read in the opposite direction. And because time is like, we can kind of view it as like an increasing of numbers, like years just increase.
Mm.
It makes sense to sort of do it that way.
Yeah, and crucially, like that, but that's exactly what you do when you then write negative numbers on that number line. So if you're writing your 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 going left to right, well, your -1, -2, -3, -4, -5 is going right to left. And that's exactly the same thing.
The digits are increasing. The value is decreasing.
Yes.
Yeah. Anyway, so like moving on from that, you're so sort of right about what you're saying with time being in front of you or behind you. I want to quickly mention, though, that Mandarin sees time as a vertical line going upwards usually.
Wow.
And bear in mind that these things are not universal for each language. You know, we're talking in generalities, of course, but it would be a waste of time to be saying that constantly. But yeah, so generally, you know, Mandarin speakers will see time as being a line going upwards. So you could have down week instead of next week, for example, right? So down is the future and up is the past.
Ooh, okay, so that's even more mind-blowing, because not only are they going up, down, what they would think as up is what I would think as down. I would think next week is above me if I was doing that.
That's
not next week is down. Oh, wow. That's so confusing.
We can go a step further than this, because you were mentioning, you know, pushing someone forward, pushing something forward, or you know, bringing something back. We see time as being sort of ahead of us, as in the future is ahead of us and the past is behind us. But there are other languages that see it slightly differently. So some languages will see time as being the other direction, so that the past is in front of them, the future is behind them, which makes so much more sense conceptually, because you don't know what's going to happen in the future, so you must not be able to see it. But you do know what's happened in the past because you can see it.
You're reversing through time.
Yeah, which is like, which is how, and this is really interesting, because, you know, in this article that I was reading, or, you know, some of the articles that I was reading, it mentioned about how English speakers and German speakers and French speakers really pushed forward science, right? As in, they were the people that really had the monopoly on it for quite some time. And so our understanding of time when it comes to physics and whatnot is likely going to have been, let's say, poisoned, or at the very least influenced by the language that these people were speaking, right? And so our entire conception of time could be really heavily impacted by the people who spoke, by the language that people spoke, you know, the people that study this sort of thing. I just find it really interesting, because ultimately, time going in the sense of the future being behind you and the past being ahead of you makes a lot of sense in terms of, I can see, I know what happened, and I don't know what's happening behind me. That makes so much sense. It's baffling that that's not how we do it. But yes, I guess, you know, the future is ahead of you because we're traveling forwards.
Yeah, yeah. But it's what you're experiencing.
Yeah, I mean, I guess it makes sense in that sense, but like also, I don't think that's enough. I think time being, you know, like the future being behind you just makes so much more sense in how we actually experience it.
Makes life feel a lot more scary, though.
I mean,
whoa, it's like you're on a roller coaster going backwards all the time.
Right, well, a roller coaster's at least on rails, man. You're fucking sprinting backwards. But yeah, so that shows us that there's at least an association between how you read language and how your thoughts are organized, which makes sense. I mean, so Daniel Casasanto, he's a cognitive psychologist at Cornell University. He's pointed out, or he's given this sort of way of explaining it, which I find quite useful. You know, so he's talking about different sort of metaphors and whatnot that we'd use for abstract concepts like time. So we tend to think about time and say price and, you know, things like these sort of things. We use spatial metaphors for them, right?
Mm.
So a long time. The time is long. So long is a spatial word, right? Length is quite literally a spatial dimension, right?
Mm-hmm.
We use it to describe time because something that's long, it's stretched out. So if time was longer, it would take more time for that time to happen, mm-hmm. right? That's how that metaphor sort of works. Or a high price. These examples are all from the article that I was reading, by the way. You could find that in the description. A high price. Why should price be high or low? I mean, the number, sure, right? But then again, why is it a high number and a low number, right? Like, what about those?
Why does it exist? Yes.
Yeah. Why are we using that metaphor and a spatial
metaphor? As opposed to large and small.
Yeah. Exactly. And a deep mystery is the last example that's been given.
Ooh.
Which, yeah, a deep mystery is, you get deep. And we can understand it, But you can imagine that in another language, they could have completely different sort of, you know, metaphors or words used. So, for example, we say we are a certain age, and I believe in French they say they have a certain age. I guess in German, I think the word for – you wouldn't say someone is tall. You would say they're big, they're gross, you know. And so, you know, if I was to say that you were big, that wouldn't – you know, in English, that wouldn't really convey that I was saying, oh, looks tall. Big would mean – like large in a different, like in multiple dimensions.
Two dimensions,
yeah,
at
exactly.
Least, yeah.
And I find that quite interesting that there are all these little differences, right? So Daniel Casasanto, what he said is that this might have something to do with people remembering things based on what you pay attention to. Because as we know, you're more likely to remember something that you pay more attention to, right? And if a language necessarily makes you pay more attention to certain things, then they're going to be sort of more in your memory. They're going to be more available to you when you're sort of using that language, right? Mm-hmm. And the kind of result that this ends up having, what we kind of see is that, you know, we can do tests on people where, you know, we basically have two buttons saying past or future, right? And we show people images and they need to determine whether that image is of the past or the future, like sort of sci-fi stuff, let's say, right? So very obvious, right? If you have, let's say, just for example's sake, a black and white photo of a Victorian looking person, that you would say past, right? If you have a space, age, technology, laser gun with an alien or something, you'd put that as future.
Unless
right?
you're a conspiracy theorist.
Or unless you're a Star Wars fan. So
yes, a long time ago. Yeah. That's always been very incongruent, the start of Star Wars movies. What? You what?
Is that what? Okay, sure. Isn't the galaxy far, far away?
True.
Far, far away.
Double far.
Exactly.
Big, but big away.
But the point, though. Yeah. But the point being that, you know, if you give someone that test of sort of showing them images and they have to press a button determining whether that image is a past image or a future image sort of thing, very, very easy. That's not the actual test. What you do is you could put the past one on the left or right of the future one, right? So if the past is on the left and you're speaking a language wherein, you know, the past is generally to the left, so say where you read left to right, so say English or French or German or any of those languages, you will see people perform sort of better or do it more quickly when it's in the correct, in quotes, correct order, as in past on the left and future on the right. They take longer to do it if future is on the left and the past is on the right. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So if you swap the sort of natural direction for that language speaker, they will they'll take longer to perform that task. And if you have a sort of, say, the past on the top and the future on the bottom, has no effect whatsoever. But with a Mandarin speaker, if you have those, if you have them in the wrong way, sort of top to bottom, that has an effect. And that's obviously for monolinguals, right? And I should just say as well, you can sort of change how quickly you can process this information by just making someone, like training someone to read things from sort of right to left. So if you sort of, if you basically just give someone like sort of mirrored text and teach them to read that, they'll perform better on that sort of test, mm-hmm. even when the sort of buttons are the wrong way around. Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, totally. The idea of doing that, just thinking about that, having the buttons on the wrong side, that's freaking me out.
Like, you would notice it. You would notice it. And like you might not even notice why you're noticing it. It would just feel wrong.
Yeah, it's like when you do one of those tests to check if you have like a cognitive bias against like people of a certain group, mm-hmm. and they like put the buttons in certain places.
I don't feel the need to take those tests often, Luke, because I
don't see color.
No, that would be a colorblind test. No, I don't take the bias tests because I've never displayed any bias to anyone ever. Sorry, go on.
Yeah, basically in the bias tests, they place the button in such a way that's going to detect your bias.
Right.
Does that make sense?
I guess.
Because it's all about the micro, how much longer it takes you to get the correct answer. Mm-hmm. Either if you're super biased, you'll just get the wrong answer. Mm-hmm. But then if you have a slight automatic bias, you'll have to like stop yourself,
like the hesitation,
and then press it. So it's about the automatic response you have.
That's so interesting.
Yeah.
Wow. But yeah, no, it's really interesting. But what we've been talking about up until this point is just monolinguals. So when we bring this into sort of bilinguals, it gets really interesting. So I've got a quote here from Panos Athanasopoulos. Panos Athanasopoulos.
You really need to start reading your notes before we start this.
I read it so many times. It's a long Greek name, and like, I don't know what it is. My brain, I just really, like, if I'm reading something long,
yeah,
my brain sometimes is just like, eh. It creates a shortcut.
Yeah.
I don't read the thing. It's just, I know what that is. I don't need to read it. And it's not conscious.
Yeah.
It's just
when
automatic.
I do my Sci Guys episodes, every complicated name, I like write it out phonetically in my notes beforehand.
I've done that before, and it just makes it worse. Like, I honestly, it's, we just need to deal with me butchering names just a little bit at first.
Okay.
It's not a lack of respect. I just have ADHD and I'm very stupid. Anyway.
And are not Greek.
Remains to be seen. I was going to do a Greek accent, but I don't even know what a Greek accent sounds like. Anyway, with bilinguals, you are literally looking at two different languages in the same mind. This means you can establish a causal role of language on cognition if you find the same individual changes in their behavior when the language context changes. So, if we look at sort of bilingual Mandarin and English speakers, they had a preference for left-to-right mental time over right-to-left, but they were also quicker to react to the pictures, the pictures and the buttons, if the future button was below the past button. So in Mandarin, you remember, future is down and past is up. So if you've got a button that says past on top, above the future button, then that's natural.
You're Gucci, yeah.
That's good. But also, because they're bilingual English and Mandarin, they show a preference for both. So if the button is on the left, if the past button's on the left and the future button's on the right, that helps. If the past button is above the future button, that also helps.
What if the buttons are diagonal?
Right. Well, I'm not I'm not super sure, Luke.
I feel like they'd be superhuman at that point.
So
they finished the test before they started the test.
Well, yeah, but what to take from this is that they see it in sort of they've got two, not necessarily contradictory, but they've got two different views of the direction of time.
Yeah.
So sort of, top to bottom makes sense, but also left to right makes sense for them. But what's more interesting than this is that that you can kind of like sort of mix and match different languages with different conceptions of time and kind of put them together to see what happens, right? So Swedish, time is in front of you. So future is front time. It's literally the word translated into English. The Swedish word framtid is front time, right? In another language, Aymara, I think it is, which is from, I think, Bolivia, Chile, Peru, and Argentina, future means behind time. So they see, as I was saying earlier, they see future as being behind them. So they'll make backward gestures to the future, whereas, you'd make forward gestures to the future otherwise. And when you sort of like, when you start to try to look at all of this, they've started trying to do more studies on, well, what happens when things sort of like contradict, or what happens when, like, how does this sort of switch work? And when we sort of look at this, what we find is that, you basically kind of switch between different languages. So it's also affected by how well you know or understand the language, the sort of effect that it has. So, if you're not as good at Mandarin, the top to bottom thing will not have as much of an effect on you as if you're quite good at Mandarin, right? So your understanding of the language changes how that impacts you, right? Essentially, what we're finding is that, people can hold like two different conceptions of something in their head. And when you have sort of two contradictory things, it depends on the language that is being spoken. Mm-hmm. So they took German speakers and English speakers, and bilingual German and English speakers. There's slightly different future tenses between English and German. So in German, you can say it rains tomorrow. Not in German, obviously, but you translate those words into German. You can literally say the words for the German words for it rains tomorrow. You don't need to use the future tense in that grammar. Whereas in English, we'd need to say sort of it will rain tomorrow, right? You can't just say it rains tomorrow. If you say it rains tomorrow, that sounds like it's a continuous action, like it always rains
tomorrow.
Exactly. So it just slight differences in grammar, right? So in 2013, what they did was they took people that spoke sort of futureless languages, let's call them, and they wanted to see whether they had a different relationship to the future compared to sort of, people that have more sort of common future tenses that they use in those languages. So those would be sort of English, French, Italian, Spanish, and Greek. Those would be the sort of future or futured languages, as they called them. And the futureless languages like German, Chinese, Japanese, Dutch, those languages, again, it's not that they don't have a future tense. It's that the future tense is pretty similar to the present tense.
It doesn't modify the word in the same way that ours does. Like, well,
yeah, look, here's the thing. Grammar is difficult and complicated. Like, yeah, we can use the present tense to mean something that's happening in the future. In certain cases, I think we can use the simple present to mean the future. Like, oh, we're going to the cinema tomorrow. We are going.
Yes, present tense.
It's present.
Yeah, and then you modify it with tomorrow.
Yeah, just say tomorrow, and then you understand from context, yeah. But it's complicated, but let's just think of them as futureless languages and futured languages. All you need to know is that a common construction of this language means that you don't need to use future grammar to refer to something in the future,
yeah,
in this context, right?
Yeah.
Very complicated, but what we basically found is that the futureless languages were more likely to engage in future-focused activities, like putting money into savings, like being less likely to smoke, being more physically active. And now the thing is that what kind of problem might you find with this study in itself? Like, is there any confounding factor you can
think
of?
Well, obviously, the people who speak the language are more likely to live in a different country. And so you're looking at societal differences,
yeah,
not necessarily language differences.
Cultural differences, yeah, is the main thing, yeah. And so what they did was they went and looked at this again and tried to control for the cultural differences. And the you know, these were differences of like sort of 31% were more likely to put money into savings in the first experiment, right? So all of these numbers I'm giving you are from the first experiment where they didn't control for culture. So it would be 31% more likely to put money into savings, 24% less likely to smoke, 29% more likely to be physically active, and 13% less likely to be medically obese. All of these sorts of things they controlled for socioeconomic status and religion. But when they went back to do it again and sort of controlled for the cultural sort of aspects, there was a much, much weaker correlation. But still, according to the researcher, the hypothesis still seems surprisingly robust. But there was still something there, it seemed. Not insignificant, but the differences fell dramatically. So it seems that language may have an effect on how we, outside of just culture, it may have an effect on actual behavior, not just how you perform in weird experimental tasks or how you kind of explain stuff, but actually how you relate to things, which makes sense, you know?
Well, either that language does have that effect,
yeah,
or that the places where it is normal to do those things developed that in their language, or would that be controlled for in the cultural bit?
I don't think you really can control for that, and I feel like what you're saying isn't I don't know how much that would hold up, because what you're kind of saying there, I guess, is that people are just naturally more likely to do this thing, and so that is like their language evolved based on that. So you'd then be saying there are this group of people that are naturally more likely to avoid.
Not necessarily naturally genetically, but like if they are, like, for example, if you're in an area of the world where it has harsh winters, you're more likely to think and empathize with your winter self, because your winter self is really going to need your summer self to stack some food away, right? Whereas if you're in an area that doesn't have as harsh winters, you're not needing to do that quite so much.
But then how would this work for people that speak that language without living in the same country? Or people that are bilingual?
Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, no. So I think it seems like, from what we can see, it seems that language does have an effect on the way that you think,
right,
when using that language. That's the interesting thing,
yeah,
there, because we can see differences when people switch between languages. Like, they literally think differently depending on the language that they're sort of using. But I feel like it makes some degree of sense based on what we were kind of talking about earlier, which is you're focusing more on this sort of thing, right? So when you're speaking a language, right, and that the kind of all the constructions of that language are in your brain, you're kind of being given like a sort of guideline, right, for how to describe things and how to think about things generally. Because if it's more natural to sort of think about, it's more natural to describe something in a way in one language, you're then, it's easier to think about it in that way, if that makes sense, right? So if a language sort of uses time, sort of discusses time as being the future is ahead of you, right? It's more natural for you to think about things that way or conceive of things that way, because that's the framework that you've been given by that language. Mm-hmm. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, and even just thinking about, like, I don't know if this is just me, but like thinking about what you said about German, where it says like it rains tomorrow rather than it is going to rain tomorrow, yeah. Right? I empathize with it is going to rain tomorrow. That makes me think I should make some plans because it's going to rain tomorrow. Whereas it rains tomorrow sounds like that's tomorrow guy's problem. Now, that may just be me.
That's really interesting because we found the opposite with those things, because it rains tomorrow is using a present tense construction. So that the idea is, do they see the future? Is there less separation between themselves and their future selves because they're using a present tense to describe something that's happening in the future? Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
But I mean, again,
maybe it's just because it's not the way I speak. So I'm thinking that guy's not me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to prepare for that guy because he doesn't use the grammar I use.
And also it's very broad and we can't use one person's experience to extrapolate out because it is so complex. But yeah, there's this Aboriginal tribe in Australia. Do you know what cardinal directions are?
Gosh, no. Is it like angles?
North, south, east and west.
Yeah.
To basically... Like, instead of saying left or right, they'll use north, south, east, and west. So when we talk about something, right, if I want to say, let's say there was an apple, right, and it was next to you,
yeah,
I would say, well, the apple is to the right of Luke. That's kind of confusing to some extent, right? Because is it to my right or to your right? North, south, east, and west is always the same.
Yeah.
I mean, unless you're at like the North Pole or whatever. unless you get to I don't think this group of people are going to spend a lot of time at the North Pole.
I'm assuming this is a language that probably developed it's an Aboriginal language, mm-hmm. So it probably developed in sort of one large landmass as opposed to like moving all over the world.
Aboriginal tribes in Australia actually travel a lot more than you might think.
But what I mean is it's fixed landmarks. It's relative to fixed landmarks because they don't necessarily have a compass when they develop this language.
Oh, but so, they don't. So this is the thing. They don't actually need to use land. I was about to tell this story. I'll just give you the quote now.
Yeah.
I'm standing next to a five-year-old girl in Pormpuraaw, a small Aboriginal community on the western edge of Cape York in northern Australia. When I ask her to point north, she points precisely and without hesitation. My compass says she is right. Later, back in a lecture hall at Stanford University, I make the same request of an audience of distinguished scholars, winners of science medals and genius prizes. Some of them have come to this very room to hear lectures for more than 40 years. I ask them to close their eyes so they don't cheat and point north. Many refuse. They don't know the answer. Those who do...
They refuse!
Yes. Those who do point, take a while to think about it, and then aim in all possible directions. I've repeated this exercise at Harvard, in Princeton, and Moscow, in London, in Beijing. Always the same results. So this is from a Scientific American article from 2011. Lira Boroditsky, I think, wrote it. Yes, I feel like you're trying to... I feel like what you're trying to do is like understand this in your brain. Stop doing that.
But how do they know?
I don't know how they know, but this a five-year-old knows, right?
Yeah.
Without thinking. So I feel like you're trying to think of this in your brain. You're like, well, how would I do it? I would use a landmark and be like, oh, I know this thing is north. And so they must just not travel all that much. But that's not really the case, right? You've got to remember as well, there are some animals like pigeons and whatnot that can
But we've proven that we can't do that.
Have we proven like explicitly?
I'm fairly certain there was decent testing done to show that we can't detect magnetic fields with our brains.
You are correct, yeah. I've missed that.
So how do they do it?
So I don't know.
It must be landmarks. I don't know, the sun relative to the landmarks.
Yeah, but then, okay, like, yes, but again, I feel like you're looking at this of how you would do it, which is consciously... But they're doing
it. Oh, I know. I mean, yeah. I know that they'll be picking up subconsciously these cues, and this is built into their language, and it's all fine, great. And I'm not thinking they're going like, "Where's that tree?"
Yeah.
But it's amazing that they have like almost like running in the background on the brain, theoretically, some kind of like, it's constantly detecting how far they've rotated and keeping a track of that in the way that I definitely don't do.
Yeah, but also there are some people that don't know their left from right, but a lot of people, you know, that speak English at the very least, know their left from right kind of just immediately, right? Like, I know my left and right without having to think about it.
I feel that's a memorization thing, as in, like, which one do I call right and which one do I call left? Whereas if you could speak to them in their brain language and go, on this side of you or on this side
of you,
they would know.
I suppose, yeah. I mean, I guess we have think of it more than, like, up and down. You kind of know what up and down is, mostly because of gravity, right? Mm. So there must be other things. You don't need to think what's up and what's down.
Yes, you're so right. Yeah. Yeah,
but then I get, yeah, maybe it is memorization for left and right, and it just becomes so natural that you don't notice it. But I don't know, right? The point is, but then even then, you don't need to think like what's on left, like what is that on the left or right of something? You can just see it and immediately understand from looking at two things. No, anyway, that's not the point.
I guess all I mean is that when I'm in a room, my brain is in the background. It's sort of made a little map of the room. And when I rotate, it keeps an idea of like, okay, that bottle's over there, that TV's over there, that kind of thing. But they do that in a language sense, as in like in the same way that I place where that bottle is relative to me. And if I rotate, as long as I have other landmarks, I know where that bottle is roughly. They do that with like, right, north's over there. And when I rotate, I still know where north is, and they're keeping track of that in the way that I wouldn't be keeping track of it.
Yeah, I guess. I think the key point with this is that it's a sort of absolute direction. Like it doesn't change, right? So left and right are relative to you. And that's why left and right is really difficult. It's what I was kind of saying there. Like if I say an apple is to the left of, like an apple is to the left of Luke, is that to your left or to my left?
Yeah, yeah.
And that's why like, that's why I love stage, like as in stage left, stage right, upstage, downstage.
That's why you're always on boats, isn't it, Corey? What? You love boats.
Oh, no. Port and starboard, nonsense. Don't like that. That's rubbish. Because a boat changes direction, stage doesn't change direction. Stage stays where it is, okay? And that's why, like, I'm not even joking. Look, I'll use stage right and stage left at points where there's, like, it's not... We don't need to use it, but there's like, you know, there's a frame of reference that the stage is.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Because it's useful. And yeah. I know a lot of people that do theater or music or something. And so it's really easy to be like, especially on tour, right? Whether you are around a lot of stages.
Yeah.
It's like, where is it? A stage right?
It's so much more helpful as well. Because we have a crap. I think even if you're good at your left and rights, I think if someone says, oh, it's on your right or it's on my right.
Yeah.
There's still a brief pause where you sort of do the translational flip in your mind of, well, how are you standing relative to me? It's not automatic at all.
Well, it's like when you're trying to cross someone in the street and you're like, okay, you go right and I'll go left. No. You both go the same direction. You go right, you both go right, or you both go left.
Interestingly, sorry, one little thing, kind of relative to language, culture, that kind of thing. There was a study I saw once that was to do with which culture naturally moves which way when you approach someone in the street.
Yeah.
And like British people go the opposite way to like Japanese people, more likely. And I wonder if that's like, you know, when there's like unwritten rules of language, like if someone talks about the weather in Britain, that for some reason there's an unwritten rule that you don't disagree with their opinion on the weather. It's a bit cold out today. You don't go like, no, it's actually not. It's quite warm. For some reason, that's a weird unwritten language, unwritten rules of English language. In that same way, you know, coming across someone who like goes a different way to you naturally when you cross them in the street, you might like naturally sort of dislike them a bit more, or like think that they're not like you in any way, or not trust them, or those kind of things, because they don't have the same sort of priors as you, the same sort of assumptions as you.
I mean, maybe I wouldn't say, I don't know. I mean, there's a lot of different things that would come into like how you view other people. Do you know what I mean? Like we were talking about maybe in another episode about how kids can people don't like autistic people without knowing they're autistic.
Yes.
We found in studies that like, you know, people will and not just kids, like adults, you don't need to know that someone's autistic. They don't even need to be like very sort of like sort of, let's say, obviously autistic, if we're using quotes there, like sort of like, you know, like very obviously autistic. We do notice a difference in how like autistic people are treated, even though not a single person is even aware that person is autistic.
You had a conversation like this recently, didn't you, where someone was sort of complaining about someone and you were like, dude, they're autistic. This is why you're experiencing this.
It's
not their fault.
Like, yes, someone. Well, no, someone was. It's less like, oh, I don't like them. But it's
like they don't come out their room.
Well, no, it's. Oh, right. Yeah. No. Absolutely. I think there was that situation, but there's also other situations where, like, it's like I was hanging out with some people, and you know, some of them, like, they were like 19, 20 ish. You know, like friends of friends, and so I was like, these people are so weird and horrible, and I don't like them. I was like, why do I not like them? The person I was with, they were like, they're teenagers, remember? And I'm like, ah, oh, yeah.
Wow, Corey.
That makes sense.
You just got old.
Well, no, I just mean,
congratulations.
But you know what I mean? It's like, once I know you're teenagers, I'm like, oh, well, you're in that conception of my brain. You're fine. Yeah. Like that's you're being exactly as I'd expect you to be as teenagers. But if I'm thinking that you're like in your like mid 20s, you're annoying. Stop.
Right.
And the same for like, you know, if you're talking to like if someone's autistic, right? Like there have definitely been times where I'm like, I don't know about this person. Mm. I'm getting a vibe off them and it's not a vibe that I don't get it. I don't know what the vibe is.
Yeah.
But I'm on edge. And then like, you know, someone's like, "Oh, they're autistic." I'm like, "Oh,
I suppose that's because your brain is sort of inferring intent to things that are not intentional." Well, and then as soon as you understand there's no intent, then it's like, oh, that's a better explanation.
Not even that. Yeah. Just not like, oh, they're doing or saying things. Just like, it's vibe. Just a vibe that is just something feels different.
But that's what I mean by priors. That's what I meant is like, if you have like general cultural priors, like just assumed things that you assume everybody else knows, and then somebody doesn't go along with the priors that you think are things, you get a sort of cognitive dissonance, low-level subconscious thing that just goes like, it's almost like when you're car sick and your body's like, I've been poisoned. Yeah. I've been poisoned. What's going on?
I'm feeling wobbly.
The eyes are not matching up with the ears. Yeah. Ah! So like it's like some dissonance. And then as soon as you understand what's causing the dissonance, then you're like, oh, okay, fine. I now understand.
I totally agree with you. I was kind of thinking of it as sort of like people understanding this as you being like, oh, when you go the wrong way, like culturally people you think less of someone. And I really, sometimes I'm listening and I'm like, I really don't want the people listening to take what we say as like an absolute rather than just like
sure,
a,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? But no, you're so right. Like breaking, I think the way I would say it is breaking social, like any kind of social rule, like it kind of confers a negative reaction, even subconscious. Do you know what I mean? And that's not me trying to correct or anything. That's just me saying it in a way that I understand it better. Do you know what I mean?
And I also just do want to be very clear. The study that I read was only saying that different countries automatically go different ways.
Yeah.
It wasn't saying that we then dislike those people.
It was
just about which way countries naturally go when they cross in the street.
What I find interesting about that, though, is that it feels like that should be based on what direction you drive. Like what direction...
Yes, and it wasn't. That was the point.
No, I know.
It was also not correlated
with direction. That's why I didn't say that. Yeah. Because the only thing I remember about that study is that if I were to have said that, like surely it must just be what side of the street you drive on. I know that's wrong.
Yeah.
I can't remember what they found, but I do remember the study based on that. Let's get back into the sort of what we're talking about, language and spatial understanding. So this Aboriginal tribe, they use cardinal directions, north, south, east, and west. So nothing is based on sort of, oh, to the left of Luke or whatever. It's to the north, to the south, to the east, to the west. And they just naturally understand that, which is really interesting because we don't even know how they're understanding that. Like you and I right now have just gone off on a whole tangent because we're trying to figure out. And a 5-year-old child is like, that's north, stupid. Do you know what I mean? Like, she just gets it and we don't. And that's I think the thing to take away from this is sort of less the, language changes your brain in a sort of what's the really good film that I really like called
Arrival.
Yes, Arrival. So in Arrival, Amy Adams' character, the weirdest thing that happens is that I don't want to spoil it. Actually,
it's like 10 years old, Corey. You can spoil it.
Okay, so I will spoil the film. basically, the end of it is Amy Adams learns the alien language, and these aliens see time as being sort of cyclical or non-linear rather than cyclical. Their language is cyclical, but time is non-linear to them. And so from understanding their language, Amy Adams then has the ability to see time non-linearly. And I don't think it's necessarily like that. Like, oh, you suddenly get the ability to have your consciousness travel through time because, you know, you learn a language. But learning a different language or growing up speaking a certain language obviously sort of primes you to understand things in a way that is built around the framework of that language, right? You know, if two words are similar in English, right, we'll obviously have some kind of connection between them there, like sun and sun, as in sun in the sky and sun from my loins, right? Like, in English, we're likely to have more of a connection between those two words than, in a language where those two words don't share any etymological roots, even if, I'm not saying they share etymological roots in English, but don't share any sort of like, any sounds or anything, you know, any sort of phonetic similarities between each other. We're likely to see more of a connection between those two words, and especially through like art and media and culture, wherein, you know, wordplay is a thing, and, you know, we might draw connections between certain things. So, like, goodness me, I think in German there's a phrase, the donkey calls itself first.
Hello, first. Nice to meet you.
No. So when you say, when you're speaking in English, let's say, you say, Luke and I did this. But some people might say, me and Luke did this. That would be grammatically incorrect. It doesn't matter because however you explain stuff to people and they understand it, that's language. There you go. You're doing it correctly. Well done. But, you know, it's a grammar rule that you don't, that you say the other person first, right? So in German, it's like donkey calls itself first.
Is that an insult to say you used grammar incorrectly, therefore you're a donkey?
Well, it's like kind of like, you know.
You flippin' donkey.
I guess when you assume you make an ass out of you and me. You know, that sort of thing, right? It's just a sort of like, you know, if someone's got their elbows on the table, there might be like a silly little phrase that you say when someone's got that. Do you know what I mean? It's just like a, like, hey. Don't do, or like, you know, when a parent says, don't make faces or okay. That sort of stuff, right? Now, I'm not saying that this is absolutely the case, but these sort of like idioms and phrases and whatnot kind of filter through into your understanding of the world, right? Mm-hmm. Without you even realizing it. And so my point is that, like, almost necessarily, what language you speak or what languages you speak fluently are going to influence your mindset to some degree, but also your general understanding of things. And what I find really interesting is that, you know, learning more languages, you kind of switch into a different understanding when you're speaking that language. And my idea for that would be that, well, yeah, because it's the path of least resistance, right? It'd be really difficult to try and speak German try to speak, say, Mandarin, and, you know, say you're saying like next week and you're literally translating that from English into Mandarin and saying next week, because, you know, Mandarin speakers will be like, what are you talking about? You mean down week? Down week? You're like, oh yes, down week, right? It's a path of least resistance. And, you know, in learning that language, you learn to conceptualize that sort of, those sort of things in the way that best suits that language. You know, I feel like there's a lot of talk of like, ooh, it's gonna totally rewrite your brain, blah blah blah. And yeah, like it does show neuroplasticity, like, you know, learning multiple languages and that having difference, that changing how you maybe conceive of things when using those languages. But I feel like people can sensationalize it in a way that makes it seem less real than it is.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
I also had this really interesting conversation with my wife a few weeks ago. So my wife thinks in words, right? So she thinks in words, she thinks in sentences. Mm-hmm. And I think in abstract thought. Mm-hmm. So I don't have any little voice going on in my head. I can do, and if I get anxious sometimes there's a little voice, like a little narrator, which I think is probably the normal experience. But it got me thinking about whether, like, is it possible that if you're thinking in language, your thoughts are bound by what is grammatically allowed in that language? And so if you have a thought that sort of doesn't quite, that you'd have to think, like, if you had a concept, right, that you'd have to do quite a long, wordy, jumbled up way of making that make sense. You could think that in a thought in an instant,
yeah,
but you might not be able to think it in language. And I wonder whether sort of the language you speak sort of puts boundaries on the way that you are able to think to a certain extent.
I think that might be the case. I mean, I would think of it maybe more as, or less of, as there being strict boundaries and more guidelines. Do you know what I mean? As in, it's not impossible, but it might be easier to think of things in some way and harder to think of things in another way. Do you know what I mean? Mm-hmm. How that makes sense? I think that might be a better way of sort of looking at it, rather than like the language dictates how you think, and more the language guides you in how you think.
Yes.
And that's kind of what I seem to have been reading here. But that's pretty much all I've got. I mean, there was the bilingual advantage hypothesis, which is the sort of idea that the parts of your brain that are involved in sort of speaking these different languages and switching between them are also used for other things. And because you're using those so much in being bilingual, you strengthen those parts of the brain, so you're better at these different things. So these would be sort of inhibition and updating those components of executive function. And there's the science goes both ways on it. I personally don't really know from what I've read what the consensus is. I found a study that kind of pointed it to being a more cultural effect. There's also data out there that it is more based on language and being bilingual. But it's an interesting thing to look at, and we might do it in a future episode, you know, look at it in more in depth. But I guess the general takeaway from this is that, yeah, the language that you speak, and not just the, you know, languages that you're speaking, have an effect on kind of how you think. Not necessarily a huge effect on, you know, things that, you know, like your ability to save and whatnot, or your tendency to save or whatnot, but at least some effect we've noticed. And I find it quite interesting.
Absolutely. That's so fascinating, Corey.
It's just one more thing. It's the quickfire quiz.
Dun, 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 dun. Bilingual edition.
So the rules for the quickfire quiz are the same as always. I'll ask one question. That's one question between you and the audience. Look, the first person to answer the question after finished asking wins. What do they win?
They win a little subscription to Duolingo, paid for by Corey.
No, no, thank you. I don't even pay for my own. So the question for you is... Ça va?
Ça va bien, I do.
Correct. Well done, Luke. Well, well done. I hope you beat everyone, including the French people that are listening. There's just one last thing to do, because we lied a little bit earlier. There's one last thing to do.
Ah.
Got to thank some new patrons.
Ah, bonjour, patrons. Merci beaucoup.
So I would like to say thank you to Bread Wardo.
Muchas gracias, Frankie Neve.
Vielen Dank, Gato Tequila.
I'm going to attempt some Mandarin here. Sai, sai. Cass!
Thank you, Febsa 44. That was difficult enough. No other language for you.
Grazie, Anna.
Thank you, Kaya. Chaya. I'm not sure. I'm sorry.
Obrigada or obrigado, Hila.
Thank you, Jonas Holzer or Jonas Holzer.
Thank you, Anna Carvalho.
Thank you, Freya.
Thank you, Kitty for Men.
Thank you, Alexandria Martin.
Muchas gracias, Jerry Softball.
I love you, Olivia. Thanks.
I want to say a really big thank you.
I'm so sorry, Corey. I'm usually all right at Scottish. Say thank you for me.
Thank you.
Kimberly Rivera.
Cheers, Sapphire Cookie.
Thanks, Psychodactyl.
And finally, a big old thank you to Sammy the Snack.
What a snack you are.
Well, that is it for all of our new patrons this month. If you want to be thanked in the next Patreon vote episode, go ahead and join our Patreon at patreon.com/SciGuys. But that is all from us. Before we go, we'd like to thank all of our patrons with an extra special thank you to executive producers Danito and Glitch Rabbit. And thank you for watching. You can find the full references for this episode down in the description. Subscribe for new episodes every Sunday, and why not leave us a nice wee comment. You support the pod at patreon.com/SciGuys, or you can find and contact us at SciGuysPod on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, YouTube, and at SciGuys on TikTok too. Or you can send us an email at SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
That's SciGuysPod@gmail.com. SciGuysPod@gmail.com.
You can follow me at NotCorey everywhere.
You can follow me at LukeCutforth everywhere.
Ciao.
You can follow me on Duolingo as well, at LukeCutforth. Come learn some Spanish with me.
You want to say bye?
Oh, adios.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Step into modern luxury at Langham in Grandview. Your boutique, studio plus suite awaits with a premium kitchen, spa-inspired bathroom, and elevated finishes throughout. Just steps from your door, lounge poolside in a private cabana, unwind in the hydrotherapy spa, perfect your swing with virtual golf simulators, or visit the fitness center for a Peloton ride. Availability at Langham is limited. Reserve your studio plus suite today at livepreferred.com.
Every business has an ambition. PayPal Open is the platform designed to help you grow into yours. With business loans so you can expand and access to hundreds of millions of PayPal customers worldwide. And your customers can pay all the ways they want. With PayPal, Venmo, Pay Later, and all major cards. So you can focus on scaling up. When it's time to get growing, there's one platform for all business. PayPal Open. Grow today at paypalopen.com. Loan subject to approval in available locations.